Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Brian Bouchard. He is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney in Manchester, New Hampshire. And today we're going to be talking about e-cigarettes, unisex bathrooms, prayer time, and other new accommodation requests and how to respond. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, your firm has been a great supporter of the HR Power Hour, and I certainly appreciate that, so I want to make sure that I say that. And by the way, I was over at your Sheehan Finney event that happened a few weeks ago, and I got to tell you, it was great. LAR update event, full day. It was fantastic. Very, very good. As a matter of fact, I saw this program, and that's why I said, oh, my gosh, my listeners have to hear this.
That's too kind. I mean, the employment seminar, it's almost like a fine wine. I think it gets better and better each year.
Well, you know, to your topic and to your statement, one of the things that gets said is the times, they are changing. And there's no question that if you would have asked me maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, about e-cigarettes or unisex bathrooms, you might have heard about prayer time. That is not necessarily completely new, though, maybe how we handle it is. There are all these unique and new accommodation requests being made. Why do you think that is? Why is there such an uptick suddenly in this area?
The uptick in this area can be explained in a few ways. One is, first, advances in technology. When you're talking about e-cigarettes and accommodations related to e-cigarettes, you know, e-cigarettes didn't exist in, you know, I think back in 2010. So it's a novel accommodation. It's a novel technology that employers are going to have to face and they're going to have to deal with. And in terms of other accommodations that you might have that are really coming about because of technology improvements, just look at, you know, remote employees, access offline. If you think back in, you know, since 2005, remote employee access and telecommuting access has increased, I think, 7.85%. And the reason is because a lot of this technology didn't exist back in 2005, back in 2007. The first iPhone came out in 2007. And in terms of other accommodations, gender accommodation, transgender accommodations, unisex bathroom accommodations, these are things that obviously aren't technology related, but it's something that society as a whole has become much more attuned to, and that's creating some complications for employers.
Well, most employers, when they think about this, think of it as the fact that, hey, this relates to the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. In fact, it's partly that, but there are other types that come into the accommodation area. Can you talk a little bit about the general, where this all comes from, and then we'll get into, obviously, some of the specifics.
In terms of transgender and unisex bathroom accommodations?
Correct, yes.
Okay, yeah. A lot of employers do think of it as an ADA type accommodation, which is true, and it's also not true. There is a recognized quote unquote disability, gender dysphoria, and employers, particularly in New York's new legislation, are required to accommodate for that. The issue with calling gender identity accommodations an ADA accommodation specifically is that most people who identify with a different gender that's not on their birth certificate don't think of themselves as having a disability. What is happening right now is that gender identity accommodations are moving away from the ADA arena, and they're entering into the Title VII arena, particularly under the definition of sex in Title VII. Now, we could talk at length about the history of that term and how it was added to Title VII in its initial inception. But what the DOJ has come out and said, and what the EEOC has come out and said, is that the term sex in Title VII doesn't just mean gender. It also includes sexual orientation and gender identity. And we're seeing that play out right now in North Carolina.
Well, you're right. We're seeing that on a national level, certainly in the North Carolina area. Well, we're thinking about accommodations. Before we get into, again, the specifics, talk to me a little bit about what your firm is telling employers that they have to really think about and why this is so important. What are the risks behind it?
Well, the risk behind not accommodating people with a different gender than what's on their birth certificate is obviously you have your standard risks of a lawsuit under Title VII, a lawsuit under the ADA. And so those are things that employers are definitely attuned to and that they're aware of. In terms of what we're advising employers to do and how to approach the idea of unisex bathrooms is if possible, and if possible, allow or construct, actually, a single-occupancy unisex bathroom or allow multiple-occupancy gender-neutral bathrooms. If that's not workable, we're actually advising employers to allow employees to use the facilities for the gender in which they identify with. And it's very difficult to advise employers on this issue right now because this is a legal issue that is somewhat in limbo. It's still in its infancy. We know what the DOJ thinks about this issue. We know what the EEOC thinks about this issue. But courts have yet to really weigh in on how gender identity plays into the ADA and how gender identity plays into Title VII.
So when you're talking to employers as they're thinking about how they're having to deal with this, what do you feel are like steps that they should look at when somebody asks for an accommodation? What are some of the things that they have to, because I mean, look, anybody can ask for anything, Brian. Let's be upfront with that. How do they really determine, hey, I actually have to take this one seriously, this one, we have to take everything seriously. Let's clarify that. But how do we know the difference? How do we really understand, or do we just have to accommodate everything?
In terms of gender identity, we're almost approaching a point where the idea of unisex bathrooms or allowing people or employees to use the facilities what they identify with is just becoming ubiquitous, where it's going to happen. Look at the three presidential candidates right now. They all have come out, and they're all on the record saying that people should use the facility in which they identify with. From an employer's perspective, it's difficult, and what I caution employers to think about is if you have an employee who comes to you and says, I want to use, and you perceive this employee to be a male, and this employee identifies as a female and wants to use the female restroom, engage in an interactive dialogue with this employee, because it may be that this employee has gender dysphoria, and that would be considered a disability under the ADA, and to just not accommodate that employee or to not engage in an interactive dialogue whatsoever would surely be a violation of that employee's rights. So the best thing employers can do right now is to have an open dialogue with their employees, find out where they can find middle ground, and accommodate them if possible.
All right, so we've made a determination that it's important for them to take everything seriously. Should they document this? Should there be a documentation of someone who comes in and makes a request for an accommodation? How should this be done? How should HR or business owner look at the paper side of this? Because somebody's going to say, well, you accommodated for one thing, you didn't accommodate for another. How is this record keeping also kept?
I cannot stress record keeping enough, and this is a personal battle that I sometimes have with employers to document everything, keep records of everything, even if it's just a small little email that you're going to print, sign off on, and put in the employee's personnel file. And the reason documentation and record keeping becomes really paramount in these types of situations is number one, you want a record of who you gave an accommodation to. So that way, if another employee comes, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, you can look back into the files and say, okay, we gave an accommodation or we didn't give accommodation in this specific instance. Therefore, if this new employee requests accommodation, we should model our current practice on what was done previously, so long as you're still within the legal strictures of the law. In other words, you want to aim for consistency, and that's what documentation does. The other thing that documentation does, and this is why it's very important, is that the ADA and Title VII for religious accommodations requires that employers engage in, like I said before, the interactive dialogue, the interactive process with their employees. And having a record of that can often show that an employer has been reasonable, was willing to work with the employee to find some sort of accommodation. And if an employer finds itself in a lawsuit over this issue, those records can be the make or break in the case.
Well, we've always talked about making sure that somebody is record keeping, and let's be honest, that's probably the hardest part, as you said, to get people to do that on a consistent basis. But if there's certainly ever a way to make it, you know, really make it stressed, I think today would be today's environment certainly is an important aspect of this, without question.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
All right, so you know, one of the let's kick it off here. Let's kick off with the first one, which is certainly one that has been talked about before, but certainly has maybe some more aspects to it, and that's a religious accommodation. Mm-hmm. Kind of give me the overview of how big an issue this really is.
This has been on the top of the EEOC's agenda recently, and it's becoming much more prevalent of an issue. I think the EEOC, you know, they release statistics every year, and if you follow the number of complaints that the EEOC has brought on behalf of people who were discriminated against on the basis of their religion or denied a religious accommodation, I think back in 2014, that number was 14% of all EEOC cases, which is a very large percentage of what the EEOC does. So this is a very big issue, and employers need to be aware that, particularly with some recent cases that have come out, that religious accommodations are being recognized by the EEOC. They're being tracked by the EEOC. The EEOC is very much engaged in making sure that all employees are not discriminated against on the basis of their religion. And to the point of what I was mentioning earlier about cases that have come out, employers somewhat have a duty to accommodate an employee or a prospective employee, whether or not they actually know about an employee's religious beliefs or practices. And we can get into that. It's the Abercrombie and Finch case that came out last summer in 2015.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, sure. I'd be happy to. This is a case that, as I said, came out in 2015. It's actually a Scalia opinion. And what happened was a young woman went to an Abercrombie store and applied for a job. She was otherwise very well qualified for the job, and under Abercrombie and Finch's, they have a checklist, she would have been immediately hired. During the interview, however, she was wearing a headscarf or an hijab, and that violated Abercrombie's quote-unquote look policy. And because of that, she wasn't hired at all. There was no discussion with her about whether Abercrombie could accommodate her headscarf or whether she'd be willing to remove her headscarf or wear something different. They just outrightly denied her the job. And so she brought a complaint against Abercrombie and Finch, and the EEOC, as I said, ever vigilant in this area right now, picked up the case. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And what one of the arguments that Abercrombie advanced was that, well, we didn't not accommodate her. We didn't even have the discussion about her. We didn't exactly know that the scarf she was wearing was for religious reasons. And Scalia said, well, that's just not enough. Because under Title VII, and this is really just the holding of the case, employers cannot make an employee's beliefs or practices, whether they actually know about them or not, a motivating factor in the employment decision. And so, you know, what Abercrombie did, even not precisely knowing that this young woman's scarf was for religious purposes, they had a good enough understanding that it might have been for religious purposes, and made her religion a motivating factor in the decision not to hire her. And that was an outright violation of Title VII.
So one of the questions that always comes up in this is reasonable accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there are so many good lawyers like you out there, Brian. The term reasonable, what is reasonable mean? What are some of the, you know, what are some of the common accommodations that might be out there? What does that really mean?
Okay, so what a reasonable accommodation is, and I'm going to talk about this in terms of Title VII purposes, because it's different in Title VII than it is under the ADA. Under the ADA, and I'm not going to go into this, a reasonable accommodation is something that doesn't impose an undue hardship, and the ADA defines an undue hardship as significant difficulty or a significant expense. under Title VII, an employer has to, again, grant a reasonable accommodation unless it poses an undue hardship. But the undue hardship under Title VII is a much less onerous burden than under the ADA. And it is so because an undue hardship under Title VII is something that is more than just a de minimis cost to the organization. So the types of things that the courts have found to be undue hardships in the Title VII arena are a cost to the organization, such as, you know, building a prayer room, for instance. Safety measures. Safety measures are a big concern in Title VII cases. It often comes up where someone is wearing a traditional garb and works in a machining factory, for instance. And the traditional garb might have some flowing garments to it or something of that effect and would pose a significant risk to the employee who is working with machines. Some of the other things that have been deemed undue hardships are really how the proposed accommodation would affect coworkers, how the proposed accommodation would affect the organization as a whole. And it's really important to stress here that when we're dealing with a reasonable accommodation and undue hardship analysis under Title VII, employers have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Everything is individualized. And if I may, I'd like to give an example of
that. Sure, that would be great.
Yeah, so let's imagine, for instance, that you have a hospital in a remote area, okay? And they hire a new nurse. And this hospital in the remote area only has a few nurses on staff. And they hire a nurse. And the nurse, because of her religious beliefs, refuses to administer certain vaccinations. And so she asks for an accommodation from the hospital, saying, well, can I do other work? Can I not administer the vaccination? So under that situation, this might actually pose an undue hardship to the hospital. And the reason is because, well, let's say you only have two people on one night, and one nurse is doing one task, this other nurse would be obligated to administer life-saving vaccinations, but if she refuses to do so because of her religious beliefs, that would be a serious problem for the hospital. Take that same example, but put it in a metropolitan area and make it with a hospital with thousands of employees. Now, under that situation where a nurse requests an accommodation, the hospital would likely be required to grant it because there are other people who could administer vaccinations while she is doing other tasks. It wouldn't pose a safety risk, and it wouldn't alienate other coworkers.
So some might say, Brian, that seems to be inconsistent because you're treating one group differently than you are a number.
It's not so much inconsistent. You're not treating groups different than another. What you're doing is engaging in a case-by-case analysis of the employee's requested accommodation. And like I said before, a case-by-case analysis has to consider all the factors at play. And in the example I gave, you have, you know, one case where an accommodation would certainly create an undue hardship for the hospital. Another case where the hospital could actually grant that accommodation without it having a major effect on its operations.
One of the things it talks about is insincere religious beliefs. So somebody can't just come in and say, I believe in lamps, and I'm worshiping lamps. And I know that I'm being facetious a little here, but and if anybody out there does worship lamps, let me be up front and say that that's fine. So tell me a little bit about insincere religious beliefs and what that means.
Well, under Title VII, employers are only required to accommodate sincerely held religious beliefs. And I'm just going to back up a little bit before we delve into what it means sincere and what is not sincere, but talk about what is actually a religious belief here under Title VII. Obviously, Title VII recognizes the most common traditional religions in the world, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, but it also recognizes religions and religious beliefs that aren't common, that may be part of an informal sect of a certain religion, and really might have some, as you said, lamps, believing in lamps, might have some bizarre or what seemingly are bizarre religious beliefs. Title VII also requires employers to accommodate and also defines religion as non-theistic beliefs, such as atheism, agnosticism, and moral principles. Going beyond what a religious belief is, however, as you mentioned, the belief, whatever it is, theistic or non-theistic, has to be sincerely held. And most of the time, an employer is not going to have much of a reason to challenge an employee's religious beliefs. And in fact, I'd caution many employers on doing so, just because, as you said before, if someone, you know, believes in lamps and that's a sincerely held religious belief, but it certainly seems out of the norm, you know, Title VII recognizes that that religious belief, you know, could be an actual belief and that the employee's vigor in believing it could be sincere. But if an employer does have a reason to say, I'm not exactly sure if you know, Jones, for instance, is really, really that devout or his beliefs are sincerely held, there's a couple things that the employer can look for. The employer can look at, you know, whether the employee has behaved in a manner markedly inconsistent with a professed belief. And again, I'm going to caution here and say that, you know, this should be taken with much caution. For instance, if you have an employee who requests to have the Sabbath off, the traditional Jewish Sabbath, but doesn't follow the kosher dietary restrictions, it doesn't mean that the employee doesn't have a sincerely held religious belief. He could just be part of a different sect of Judaism. Other things to look for are where the accommodation sought by the employee is particularly popular, such as having a holiday off or, you know, Memorial Day weekend, which just happened, and whether the timing of the request renders the employee's belief suspect. For instance, if you have an employee who requests time off to go to a concert, and that request is denied for whatever reason, and then the employee comes back and says, well, you know, I need this time off because the concert's on, or well, not the concert, but I need this day off because it's Good Friday, and I'm a Catholic, and I have sincerely held religious beliefs. Well, the fact that the employee requested time off to go to a concert and then all of a sudden changed positions as soon as it was denied to have some sort of sincerely held religious belief would certainly render the person's belief suspect, and it might entitle the employer to go and do a limited inquiry into whether this person's beliefs are sincere or not.
We've been speaking with Brian Bouchard. He's an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. We've been talking about e-cigarettes, unisex bathrooms, prayer times, and other accommodation requests and how to respond. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB at 100.5 FM. And this is sponsored and presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're talking with Brian Bouchard, by the way. He's an employment attorney at Sheehan Finney, and they're a law firm in Manchester, New Hampshire. Brian, really appreciate you being on the show today.
Again, so happy to be here.
So we're talking about a whole bunch of what we would call accommodation requests that are new, maybe unique, and how we really need to be responding to them. In the last segment, we talked a lot about the religious accommodation. So now I think one of the things that we're seeing a lot of out there is this e-cigarette, this vaping, and I'll even throw in medical marijuana cigarettes, or if you want to talk about recreational marijuana cigarettes. These are all what we would call this new wave of smoking or other smoking issues that are coming into the workplace. So let's talk about e-cigarettes to start with, or vaping. You know, in New Hampshire, as well as in Maine and other states, of course, indoor smoking is pretty much prohibited. Right? I mean, right across the board, correct?
I think it's fairly ubiquitous across the United States that smoking is prohibited in indoor areas, particularly in closed workspaces.
But some of these, you know, products, which is why this is coming up with, talk about having simply some steam or some vapor of water that is really emitted. It really isn't, as they would call it, quote-unquote, smoking. So how do we deal with this?
Yeah, some of the requests that employers have had to field recently are employees who, I guess, formerly smoked and switched over to an e-cigarette, which, as you said, emits this vapor or this essentially gas substance that isn't exactly a carcinogen. And so employees have been requesting to vape when inside the workforce. And I think the best way to deal with this is to handle it as you would a general request to smoke inside the office. Take New Hampshire, for example. New Hampshire passed the Indoor Smoking Act in 2007, and that act prohibits smoking in the workplace or other places of public accommodation. And it defines smoking as lighted cigarettes, cigars, or other devices intended to mimic the effect of smoking. Now, there hasn't been a case that comes out and says that e-cigarettes fall into that last category, a device intended to mimic the effect of smoking. But I think the writing is very much on the wall on how the statute is worded, and that vaping in the workforce would be utterly prohibited. So what employers do is provide smoking breaks for the employee. Particularly, this actually has a nice crossover into the FLSA. If you're providing a 10-minute smoking break, under the FLSA, that time should probably be compensable. The other thing that employers can do is, you know, provide a designated smoking area for both e-cigarettes and vaping. Beyond that, it's a pretty straightforward issue for employers to deal with, mainly because they've been dealing with it for so long.
You know, when they talk about accommodating or having some place, a lot of places have no smoking on the premises, no smoking on the property, no smoking anywhere, and they even say, you know, this is a no smoking campus. So, you know, especially when you come to like universities, different places that maybe have rules like that, or different agencies, are they required to? Employers required to provide an area for someone to go to?
You know, I'd have to look at this, and it's important to look at this on a state-by-state basis. There might be some states out there that actually require employers to provide a designated area. In the states that I work in, Massachusetts and New Hampshire, there is no requirement to provide a specific designated area for an employer to smoke. If there's no smoking on campus, the employee simply has to remove him or herself from the campus in order to light a cigarette or use a vaping device.
Okay, so we've basically said in this particular case that we don't have to necessarily do that. So let's talk a little bit about, because obviously this is the cigarette category, the marijuana side of this. And I know certainly in the state of New Hampshire, I know that, you know, it's coming in with this medical marijuana. We've certainly had it here in the state of Maine. There are other states that are dealing with this. And of course, employers don't have to accommodate that on the premises. They don't have to accommodate that smoking. But is there anything that you would add to this in regards to employers having to deal with this issue?
Well, I'd like to add two things to that. First is that if you have employees who are using vaping devices, just be cautious of there's a new phenomenon out there, and it's been published a lot in scientific journals about marijuana vaping, which is essentially smoking marijuana, but it doesn't have the immediate noticeable effect of marijuana, meaning that you can't smell it. So just be careful of employees doing that. Also, when we're talking about medical marijuana, for instance, and its relation to the ADA, there have been cases that have come out, particularly in the First Circuit, that have said that if an employee requires or has a prescription for medical marijuana, an employer is not required to accommodate that, meaning that they're not required to allow an employee to certainly not smoke on the job, and that if an employer has a drug testing policy, the employee can still violate that drug testing policy even by smoking medical marijuana. And the reason is because that the federal government has not recognized even medical marijuana to be a permissible substance.
So one of the other questions that comes up, and this does apply to not only the e-cigarettes or even the religious accommodations, is people are looking at, or employers are looking at their handbooks, and they're saying, okay, do I have to write specific policies? Do I have to change specific policies Do I have to evaluate specific policies? And we'll stick first to the religion and the e-cigarette, and then we'll certainly get into the bathrooms and so forth. But what's your take on these two policies so far from an employer standpoint? What they have should work, or is there something we should add to it?
In terms of religious accommodations, I'd have to look at what each employer has, but what they have should be okay. I mean, religious accommodations have been around certainly since the inception of Title VII, and it's nothing new. It's just become a lot more focused by the EEOC, which has brought it into the limelight. So any policy that an employer should have should be sufficient. And the policy that an employer should have related to accommodations is, if you require an accommodation for a sincerely held religious belief, there should be an open door policy for the employee to come to the employer, the designated person, and talk about the accommodation they require. In terms of e-cigarettes, again, I don't see any need to update a policy or a handbook, only to the extent that you're gonna change the word there's no smoking on the premises, and it might be important to define that as vaping or e-cigarettes as well. Other than that, there shouldn't be any substantive changes to the policy.
Okay, that's great. All right, so let's hit the next one, which is one that is all the rage, all over the news. Certainly, conversations having to do with North Carolina, but it's really been a, if you want to call a firestorm, having to do with this transgender accommodation, unisex bathrooms. So I guess the first question, very simple when it comes to this, what are the public accommodations?
So the type of public accommodations that are generally offered in the issue regarding gender identity is either to offer unisex bathrooms, single occupancy unisex bathrooms, to offer multiple occupancy unisex bathrooms, or to allow any individual to use the facility for the gender in which they identify with. And that includes restrooms, that includes locker rooms, and in any gender-segregated facility out there in the public. Whether it's required by law or not, as I think we're where the rubber is beginning to hit the road in North Carolina.
Well, when we're talking about this segment of the law, are there actual laws that protect transgender individuals? I mean, what is the law specifically say?
Well, the law is really in a state of limbo right now, in a state of its infancy. If you ask the DOJ whether the term sex in Title VII includes sexual orientation and gender identity, in other words, prohibiting discrimination on the basis of someone's sexual orientation or gender identity, the DOJ would say, well, absolutely, the term sex includes those two bases. If you ask North Carolina, however, whether the term sex in Title VII includes sexual orientation or gender identity, the answer they're going to give you is a resounding no. And unfortunately, many cases haven't weighed in on this yet, or haven't weighed in on it in a way that there's really a definitive answer as to what the law says. But if you look at the DOJ's publications, you look at the EEOC's publications, and actually if you look at OSHA's publications, which I found it kind of interesting that OSHA's chimed in on this, what they're saying is that employers, places of public accommodation, you need to let employees use the facilities for the gender in which they identify with. And over the next, a year and a half, that's going to play out in the courts.
So when an employer has a facility and they have, let's start with the basics. So they have a bathroom or two. They have two bathrooms, typically one male, one female. But they're single unit. It seems pretty obvious to me that it's pretty easy at that point, right? They're single unit bathrooms. There's not a lot of conversation. Would it be the recommendation to take down the male-female sign and just leave them as bathroom or private area? Do we have to get to the point, or do we need to be to the point of non-identifying the bathrooms at an employer's site?
I don't know if we're at the point of having non-identifying bathrooms yet, but if an employer does have a couple of bathrooms and they're both single-stall bathrooms, single-occupant bathrooms, then what the employer should do is really make it easy on itself and take down the male-female signs or the family sign and just put up signs that say, are male/female. And there's actually signs that include a symbol for gender identity, which is a partial male, partial female. That's the simplest solution that an employer should do to avoid any legal entanglement.
So not just putting like a word bathroom on there is
I think the word bathroom would be fine, but if you have a few single occupancy stalls and right now they say male and female, I would certainly take those down and put up something that doesn't segregate on the basis of gender.
All right, so now let's talk about what you would say is public areas, and we'll do the obvious one, which would be hotels, maybe a theater, or a gas station retail store, and they may have multiple stalls, a line of maybe urinals for in the males room, multiple areas. So how do we deal with that issue in terms of identifying that, and then I'll get to the point of how to deal with what do we deal with when when somebody actually does it.
So for places of public accommodation, you threw out hotels, for instance, probably the best practice for a hotel is that if they're doing any reconstruction, install a single occupancy, gender-neutral stall. That's probably the safest and easiest way to do it. Of course, that involves construction, and if you're not involved in the construction process, that could be a hassle and an undue burden to the facility. Absent that, my recommendation to any place of public accommodation is to allow any person to use the facility for the gender they identify with. And I am fully aware that this creates some conflict. Number one, it's going to create some conflict between patrons who are uncomfortable with that idea, but at the same time, not allowing it creates some conflict between patrons who want to use the bathroom for the gender they identify with.
Well, let's go down that path as an example. So there, we've got a situation where we have somebody comes in, and they're using this public restroom, and they have identified themselves as a female, and they are biologically a male, and they go into the female restroom area, whether it be at a facility of some type, and there's a reaction in that restroom area. There's potentially a screaming, yelling, all sorts of things happening. How does an employer deal with that situation? Because they're going to be in a situation where a manager has to deal with that at that area. So how do they handle that situation? Is that different than they would handle a situation having to do with an issue at their work or in the public area?
Well, I mean, certainly if there's any screaming or yelling, it's going to be best to quell and calm that situation as soon as possible. And certainly we want to avoid any situation where workplace violence might ensue. But in terms of that situation happening and there be screaming and yelling in the bathroom, unfortunately, places of public accommodation and employers are really faced with a very tough balance right now, because on the one hand, the law seems to be trending and progressing in a way where employers and places of public accommodation are going to need to accommodate anyone who doesn't identify with the gender on their birth certificate. On the other hand, there can be significant risk just to allowing anybody to use the bathroom for the gender they identify with. And I'll give you a prime example of that is I think it's Planet Fitness actually has a nationwide policy, or had a nationwide policy at the time, where anyone could use the locker rooms for the gender they identify with. And out in Michigan, a woman was so offended by that idea that a person who was biologically born as male was using the female locker room that she sued Planet Fitness for intentional infliction of emotional distress and negligent infliction of emotional distress. And Planet Fitness was really just caught in the middle of this dispute, on the one side trying to comply with what OSHA requires and what the DOJ requires and what the EEOC requires, and on the other hand being sued by a patron who was just very uncomfortable with the idea of a biological male using the female bathroom.
So for employers that are dealing with this within their workforce, What type of training would you recommend? Is there sensitivity training? Is there some sort of diversity training? Are there recommendations for training that you would say, hey, can help employers help understand the changes that are happening, as well as what are some of the best practices you see in this area?
I think sensitivity training in this area is going to be very key, particularly as many more places of public accommodation and employers become used to the idea and allow employees to use the facilities for the gender they identify with. You know, you can find training. The EEOC does trainings. OSHA does trainings. And I want to talk about OSHA for just a quick second here. And now OSHA is one of the few governmental organizations that's come out with a very firm stance on this, on whether employers should allow employees to use the bathrooms for the gender they identify with. And OSHA's rationale for that, rationale for its policy, is that employers under its regulations are required to provide sanitary facilities for their employees. And the reason for that is because if you don't provide any facilities, that can have very adverse health effects for the employees. But what OSHA has come out and said is that if you don't allow employees to use the facility for which they identify with, then an employee would be maybe fear for their physical safety and using a different bathroom, or the employee just might not use the bathroom altogether, and that would have the same adverse health effects as not providing any facilities whatsoever. So OSHA has come out and said that employers should allow any employee to use the bathroom for the gender they identify with, or to offer unisex bathrooms, or either single stall or multi-occupancy. But going back to your initial point, I think sensitivity training in this area is going to be very, very, very important, particularly since there's no clear law on this issue yet, and what employers are being forced to do is really make policy decisions. And so having an open discussion with all their employees about why it's making a certain policy decision will help smooth the road.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB at 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB at 100.5 FM and presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Brian Bouchard. He's an employment attorney at Sheehan Finney. And we've been talking about accommodations, new accommodations, and or modified accommodations for things like religion, e-cigarettes, unisex bathrooms. And then, of course, the one we're going to talk about next, Brian, is obligations to nursing mothers.
Excellent topic.
Well, let's have a discussion about this, because I know that there have now been requirements for employers to provide a specific area for nursing mothers. Talk to us a little bit about this whole change within the rules.
Absolutely. This change came about as part of the ACA. And what it did was it amended the Fair Labor Standards Act, and it requires companies to allow nursing mothers up to 1 year after a child's birth a break time, number one, to express breast milk. And then it also requires employers to provide a facility, a room that is private for the purposes of expressing breast milk. And where this really becomes interesting is in the requirement for a private area. The private area under the statute can't just be a bathroom. It has to be, you know, secluded from view, has to be private, and it has to be an area where really someone would feel comfortable and that their privacy isn't being invaded.
So, but that could be a single stall bathroom.
In some respects, I think it could be a single stall bathroom, and I'd be willing to argue that under most search circumstances. The issue I have with it right now is that the statute expressly says that it shouldn't be a bathroom. And I think, you know, when the drafters of the statute, they're probably thinking of, you know, multiple occupant bathrooms. But just because the statute says bathrooms, I'd caution any employer to actually offering a single stall bathroom as a private room to express breast milk.
Does the statute require size? In other words, you know, how big does this room have to be? And look, I'm confident that most employers would not even think like having a closet be a room. But, you know, I want to make sure that is there anything within the rules or regs that says size of room or anything having to do with that so that we're all in compliance?
Yeah, there's not anything that I am aware of regarding a particular size of a room. It just has to be not a bathroom and, according to the statute, shielded from view and private. Now, with that said, I'd caution any employer about, you know, building this little stall in the basement of a building or as you said, offering a closet to an employee. I'd make sure it's, you know, a decent-sized room that's comfortable where an employee isn't going to feel that their rights are being prohibited or that she's being discriminated against.
Well, that, of course, makes common sense. But as I have said many times, common sense is uncommon.
Yeah, that it is.
It's very, very true. Is there any other part of this that has to do with, that employers need to be aware of, having to do with, again, obligations for nursing mothers?
Yeah, there is one interesting crossover, obviously, because this is under the FLSA. And as we know, the FLSA requires that if an employer is going to offer a break to the employee, a snack break, a coffee break, whatever you want to call it, that time is generally compensable. There are some limited exceptions out there. For a break for nursing mothers, however, the FLSA has, or the Congress has come out and said that the time for a mother to take a break and express breast milk does not need to be compensable. But with that said, however, I'd still caution employers about making it compensable or not compensable, just because if you're offering everyone, you know, compensable breaks, for instance, a 10-minute break, and a nursing mother uses that break, that specific break, to express breast milk, even though the statute says it doesn't have to be compensable, you could find your way into a situation where, you know, just because the person is using their break time to express breast milk, you could be acting in somewhat of a discriminatory manner by giving everyone else compensable time but not giving the mother compensable time. And the only other thing to really add about this subject is that if you are in a company of 50 or fewer employees, you're not required to offer nursing mothers time to express breast milk if doing so would pose an undue hardship to the company. And again, we'd go back into that whole undue hardship analysis.
No, I completely understand that. So let's talk about the last topic, which is extended medical leave. You know, the FMLA says eligible employees are entitled to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for certain medical-related circumstances. However, there's a lot having to do with this in terms of being able to extend that 12 weeks. Why don't you kind of give an overview of this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a little-known area of the ADA that many employers have been running afoul of recently, so much so, actually, that the EEOC has issued a fairly detailed and comprehensive guidance on how to approach extended leave under the ADA. And as you mentioned, we have the FMLA, and it requires that employers offer eligible employees 12 weeks of unpaid leave. That's been around for a good amount of time. Most employers know what they're doing when it comes to that. But where the ADA leave comes up is, what if you have an employee, for instance, who isn't FMLA eligible? They don't have a serious medical condition, but they're still really not able to work. Or what if you have an employee who has exhausted their 12 weeks of FMLA leave and still can't return to work? What are you required to do for that employee? Well, the EEOC has come out with particular guidance on what you're required to do, and there's regulations that say what an employer is required to do. And the requirement is that the employer offer that employee, even though they're not eligible for FMLA for whatever reason, extended medical leave, unpaid medical leave, until such a time that, the employee can really return to work, or until such a time that the that the employer views the extended leave as an undue hardship. And remember, we're talking about an undue hardship under the ADA, so there must be a significant difficulty in continuing to grant the accommodation of extended leave.
So that basically means that somebody could take a lot longer than 12 weeks.
Yeah, I've seen situations where employers have been accommodating an employee for over 26 weeks. And it becomes very difficult for an employer to really balance this out because, you know, okay, you're beyond the 12 weeks granted by the FMLA. You're continuing to take another 12, 14 weeks. But the regulations under the ADA don't actually have a timeline as to when ADA leave should end. There's no durational timeline. It just says when either the employee is able to work either with or without a reasonable accommodation, or the extended leave becomes an undue hardship. And when it becomes an undue hardship it's tough for employers to gauge because what they're facing is, okay, we have some difficulty right now in staffing, for instance, because Jones has been out on leave for 26 weeks, but are we still able to get by without him? But if we fire Jones, for instance, and hire somebody else in his place, you know, are we violating the ADA? And that's a tough analysis and a tough decision to make without really clear guidance from either the EEOC or under the regulations about how long this leave needs to be.
So what are the recommendations here as we get ready to wrap up in terms of the subject that you would recommend for employers?
Yeah, absolutely. What I'd recommend to any employer who has an employee who's under extended ADA leave is to have them submit medical certifications, much like they do for the FMLA. In fact, I'd recommend that they use pretty much the same form as the UHD medical certification form. Have the employee's doctor, physician, whomever it is, fill out those forms and determine whether the employee can work either with or without a reasonable accommodation. And that's key, with or without a reasonable accommodation, which makes it different from the FMLA. I'd also track the leave time used by the employee. Again, if you find yourself in a case where you have an ADA discrimination matter, it's helpful to say that, you know, we granted this person, you know, 30 weeks of unpaid leave. The other thing that I'd really encourage employers to do is keep an open dialogue with the employee. Ask the employee, when are you expecting to return to work? When does your doctor think you can return to work? And set timelines as to when the employee says that they can return to work and schedule them to return to work that day. So, for instance, and to be quick about this, if you have an employee who says, I'm going to return to work on June 30th, my doctor says I can return on June 30th, say, excellent, I'm scheduling you for June 30th. If you cannot return by June 30th, I need you to let me know by June 27th. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have to fill the shift for you or something like that. And it creates an obligation for the employee to keep the interactive dialogue alive and keep corresponding with the employer.
Brian, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. There's no question the times are changing.
Say that they are.
You know, one of the things that we will certainly do is right after this show, we will certainly post this broadcast as well as contact information for Brian. Again, this is Brian Bouchard. He's an appointment attorney at Sheehan Finney. You can certainly reach him at bbouchard@sheehan, sheehan.com, and, of course, the website sheehanfinney.com. But again, as I said, all that information will be on hrpowerhour.com website right after the show. Brian, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.